Hi there, welcome to Bond Investment Mentor. I'm your host, Chris Nelson, and this is a podcast dedicated to helping community financial institutions master the art of fixed income investments. If you're working for a community bank or credit union, and you have responsibilities for the investment portfolio, you've come to the right place. I'll be your personal investment guide as we help you boost your fixed income investment knowledge, level up your portfolio management skills, and help you gain the know-how you need to help your institution achieve its financial goals. In this episode, we're going to talk about the return to liquidity management. After a couple of years dealing with excess liquidity, some community financial institutions have found themselves in a borrowing position and in need of wholesale funding. Today, we'll talk about how the investment portfolio can play a role in managing liquidity and two approaches to making that happen. So if you're ready to go, let's get started. Welcome to Bond Investment Mentor. I'm glad you're here. I'm on the road this week, so my audio might sound a little different in this episode. I'm recording this in Boulder, Colorado, where I'm teaching at the annual summer session for the Graduate School of Banking at Colorado. I'll be working with community bankers and regulators over several days and teaching them about managing the investment portfolio. We'll be covering basic concepts, different types of investment securities, and understanding investment portfolio management. The students in these classes always bring a lot of good questions, and I'm looking forward to working with them this week. If you're interested in learning about the Graduate School of Banking's annual school session or any of their other programs, you can go over to bondinvestmentmentor.com/Colorado for more information. You can also check out episode 15 of the podcast, where I interviewed Michael Stevens, who is the school's president. So in today's episode, we're going to discuss how community financial institutions are beginning to focus again on liquidity management. This was something that kind of took a back seat for the past couple of years as banks and credit unions were awash with deposits and excess cash. Under those circumstances, no one was really worrying about liquidity. But things have begun to change, and we're going to get into the role the investment portfolio plays in managing liquidity and how to structure the portfolio to help in that endeavor. But before we get to that, I'm going to share a response to a question I received about Bloomberg yield tables, and we'll take a look at the latest economic data and market action ahead of yet another Federal Reserve meeting. In episode 19 of the podcast, we covered the Bloomberg yield tables and all the information that they contain. This past week, I talked with a community banker named Christy, and she had a question about the yield tables. Christy said that she was looking at a mortgage-backed security and noticed that the maturity date shown at the top of the yield table wasn't matching up with information in the section called the principal window at the bottom of each yield table scenario. She asked me why that would happen. It's a great question, and I wanted to share what I told her with you as well. So when you look at the top of the yield table, you will see the final maturity date for the security. For example, it might say May 1st, 2036. This date represents the final contractual maturity for the mortgage-backed security based on the loans in the mortgage pool when the investment was initially created. The date is based on the latest final maturity date from all the loans that are contained in the security. More importantly, once this date is set, it will never change. The other dates Christy mentioned are located near the bottom of the yield table in each of the what-if scenarios. It's near the average life and duration data. This section is called the principal window, and it shows the date period when an investor could expect to receive principal payments given the assumed prepayment speed in the scenario. Typically, as the prepayment speed changes, the dates in the principal window could adjust. For example, if we had a mortgage security that began to prepay much more quickly, the final month in the principal window would be earlier than a scenario that had a slower prepayment. What Christy found was that the latest ending date in the principal window was always several months earlier than the final maturity date on the pool. It didn't matter what prepayment speed she used, the principal window never extended to match the final maturity date. So what was going on? The short answer is that one or more of the residential mortgage loans in the MBS pool had prepaid and it was no longer in the pool. The dates shown in the principal window only consider the remaining loans in the pool. As the loans with longer final maturities had paid off, the principal window adjusted to reflect the new current longest final maturity date. Unlike the final maturity date at the top of the yield table, which is fixed, the principal window date gets updated. This created the situation that Christie saw, where the final maturity was several months before the final maturity shown at the top of the yield table. If you're evaluating mortgage pass-through securities using a Bloomberg yield table, it's a good idea to check the final maturity against the latest maturity in the principal window section. You may find that the mortgage pool is a little shorter than the final maturity would indicate. It may not be a huge difference, but it will give you a more accurate indication of what you could expect as an investor. By the way, in case you missed it, I've created a free guide that will help you navigate your way around the Bloomberg Yield Tables. It's called Understanding the Bloomberg Yield Tables and provides you with an overview of all the information in the yield tables and the differences between the different yield table types. If you're interested, you can download the guide by going to bondinvestmentmentor.com/yieldtables, and I'll leave a link to it in the episode notes. Finally, let's take a quick look at the markets and most recent economic data. It was a light week for economic data, but there were some reports that moved the Treasury markets. While inflation worries are still a factor, last week the markets were more concerned about economic weakness and signs of recession. The Philadelphia Fed released its latest monthly manufacturing business outlook report, which had a massive downside surprise as it fell to its lowest level since 1979. Elsewhere, the housing market continues to slow, as indicated by the latest pullback in existing home sales and weaker-than-expected housing starts, and a series of corporate earnings disappointments and warnings added to the pressure. When economic uncertainty is in play, U.S. Treasuries become a safe haven for investors. Treasuries rallied in response to all of the news, with the yield on the benchmark 10-year Treasury falling to 2.75%. 5-year Treasuries ended the week at a yield of 2.84%, while 2-year Treasuries yielded 2.97%. The slope of the yield curve from 2 years out remains inverted, with a spread of minus 22 basis points between the 2-year and the 10-year part of the curve. The last time we saw a curve inverted like this was in September 2000. Yield curve inversions are usually precursors to recessions, and it'll be interesting to see what the initial report for second quarter GDP looks like when it comes out in a few days. A second negative print for real GDP would meet the technical definition of a recession, though the official word will come from the National Bureau of Economic Research at some point. It's been quiet on the Fed news front as we're in a blackout period ahead of the July 27th meeting. I suppose I should also mention that there have been no surprise article leaks from the Wall Street Journal or anyone else for that matter, so it's been quiet. Based on Fed funds futures, the markets are fully expecting another 75 basis point increase to short-term interest rates. The consensus is that the Federal Open Market Committee will also hike rates by another 50 basis points at the September meeting. If you've been following the podcast for a while, you know that I don't usually pay too much attention to the longer-term outlook from the futures markets, given the degree of uncertainty. However, something I've been observing over the past few weeks is that the market has begun to price in an increasing likelihood of interest rate cuts by the FOMC, not hikes, possibly as soon as March of 2023. Keep in mind that the Fed has given no indication of a course correction until inflation is brought under control, which may not have happened by then. While we'll have to see how things play out a little more, if the economic data continues to indicate weakness, the markets may be on to something. All right, so let's move on to today's main topic. Lately, I've been having more and more conversations with clients and community bankers about liquidity and liquidity management. This is a topic that had disappeared for the past couple of years. Well, actually, it's not that the topic disappeared. Instead, the focus was on figuring out what to do with all of the excess liquidity that was lying around as a result of the pandemic, the PPP program, and huge deposit growth that had occurred. However, community financial institutions are now seeing continued loan growth, while deposit growth has leveled off or even shrunk a little in some cases. Excess cash on the balance sheet has dried up, and some community bankers are now beginning to borrow wholesale funding again. In addition, regulators are focusing more on bank and credit union liquidity and how it's being managed. This is especially true given the loss in market value that investment portfolios experienced in the past few months, which has reduced the amount of liquidity available through the sale of investments if needed. In some ways, this is one of those back-to-the-future moments. What I've been sharing with clients and other community bankers is that it's time to dust off the practices and procedures that they were using before the pandemic, because we're heading back to liquidity management as we once knew it. So given those circumstances, what should we be doing now to make sure our liquidity house is in order? And what steps can we take with the investment portfolio to help out? Today, I'm going to share with you three factors that are key to successful liquidity management for your institution. Factor number one, make sure that you have multiple diversified sources of funding. This includes the investment portfolio, but also includes the Federal Home Loan Bank, the Federal Reserve Bank, and brokered deposits, as well as other wholesale funding sources. We'll talk about the investment portfolio in more detail in just a minute, but let's talk about the other types of funding that I mentioned. Every financial institution has access to the FHLB system and can use their advances to fund the balance sheet. The source of the borrowing capacity that you have is based on the amount of loans and securities that you have pledged to the Federal Home Loan Bank. The more you have pledged to the FHLB, the larger the borrowing capacity. So make sure that you have pledged everything that's eligible to them. It's worth checking with your FHLB representative to see if there are options for you to increase your collateral and therefore the amount that you can borrow from them. The Federal Reserve is also a potential funding source through their discount window programs. If you haven't set up what's called a borrower in custody line with your local Federal Reserve Bank yet, I would recommend checking into it. It takes a little time to get things in place and establish that Fed relationship, and you don't want to wait until you absolutely need it to start the process. You can learn more about setting up a BIC line, borrower in custody, at your local Federal Reserve website. It is certainly worth doing, and I can speak from experience that knowing I had the ability to borrow from the Federal Reserve discount window with just a phone call if an emergency came up was really reassuring for me on more than one occasion. Brokered deposits are another great source of funding, and there are different ways of raising funds through the brokered deposit markets that are beyond what I'm going to be covering today. But taking the time to establish the channels for tapping brokered deposits is time well spent. Finally, you could also establish additional wholesale funding sources through the use of things like Fed funds lines with correspondent banks or bankers banks, as well as utilizing repurchase agreements or repos. As I said, the key is having multiple and diversified sources available so that you have options and flexibility. Something else to keep in mind, too, is that you'll want to test these various sources regularly to make sure that they're functioning as you would want them to if you truly needed to tap into them. So that's factor number one, having those multiple and diversified sources available. Let's move on to factor number two. Make sure that you have sound policies, procedures, and tracking of your institution's liquidity position. Now, I know that we all have a liquidity policy, but when was the last time you really sat down and read it? You might find that the policy needs updating or revising. Your liquidity policy forms the foundation for your liquidity management efforts, so it's worth checking it to be sure that it's structured the way that you need it to be. In addition, you want to be sure that you've established metrics and scorecards so that you know how your liquidity position is doing. You don't want to find out if you have a problem after it's already started and you're forced into more of a reaction mode. Establishing liquidity guidelines that show whether things are good, becoming a challenge, or have hit a critical level is key. And you want to be sure that you're checking these metrics and scorecards regularly, sometimes even monthly if necessary. You don't need to have dozens of measurements in place, but you want to make sure that you've covered your bases with enough monitoring that's robust and helps you easily understand what's happening on the liquidity front. Finally, we have factor number 3, which is to conduct regular what-if and stress test scenarios. If you have a robust reporting system in place, you'll know where you are at any given moment. But it's also important to consider how changing conditions might affect your liquidity position in the future. That's why it's good to test the system once in a while. For example, what would happen if asset growth or deposit runoff is more aggressive than you thought? What if you were to lose one or more of your wholesale funding sources? These are all ways you can develop scenarios that push the boundaries of your liquidity management plan. It's not about trying to break the system, but it is about ensuring that the institution is in a position to weather more severe storms, whether they occur internally or as part of something systemic. In conjunction with that, you'll want to make sure that you've developed a solid contingency plan so that you'll know what to do when the stuff hits the fan. It's also a good practice to test the contingency plan occasionally as well. Now that we've covered the 3 factors to managing liquidity successfully, let's talk about how the investment portfolio fits into the liquidity management plan. The investment portfolio is an essential tool in managing a community financial institution's liquidity, and there are 2 ways to utilize the portfolio for liquidity risk management. The first way is through the sale of unencumbered liquid assets. Selling investments that aren't pledged is usually considered the first line of defense in liquidity management by regulators. It is the basis for the liquidity coverage ratio, which requires banks to hold a sufficient amount of high-quality liquid assets. By raising cash through the sale of these investments, a bank can produce a source of liquidity that it can use to offset changes in asset growth or liability runoff. With the recent sharp rise in interest rates and the related fall in market value, banks and credit unions have less available market value to liquidate to raise cash. This is a major reason why liquidity is getting more attention by regulators and bank examiners these days. It's also why investment liquidity in the portfolio becomes a more important consideration. What do I mean by investment liquidity? I'm talking about the ease with which a security could be sold in the market and converted to cash. Some securities, like U.S. Treasuries, are highly liquid and can be easily sold. Other securities are less liquid and may be harder to liquidate quickly, depending on market conditions. Understanding the relative liquidity of investments in the portfolio is an integral part of managing the institution's liquidity risk, especially if investment sales need to be involved. Now, I'm not saying that you need to concentrate your portfolio in highly liquid investments like treasury securities. What I am saying is that you'll want to know how liquid your existing holdings and your portfolio are. Generating liquidity through investment sales does have 2 downsides right now. First, if you had to liquidate investments today after the recent market sell-off, you'd have to realize any losses that are there. In addition, one downside of selling investment securities for liquidity purposes is the loss of investment income. Securities sold are earning assets that are no longer on the books, and the sale of investments raises cash immediately, but it comes at the expense of future interest income that you lose by having those earning assets gone. The second way to utilize the investment portfolio to manage liquidity risk is by structuring investments to manage the cash flow they generate. This means building a portfolio that produces a steady stream of principal payments on a regular basis. Unlike the first option, it does not require the sale of any assets. An investment portfolio with regular cash flow provides an ongoing and stable source of funds to meet liquidity needs on either side of the balance sheet. If the funds are not needed when they're received from cash flow, they can simply be reinvested. Simply put, managing investment cash flow is the foundation for good liquidity management. There are different ways to structure an institution's investment portfolio to manage this cash flow. If the portfolio is composed of traditional bonds, it would need to be structured to provide regular principal payments, such as through building a bond ladder, which provides a series of staggered principal maturities. Another way to build a portfolio's cash flow capability is to use investments like mortgage-backed securities, which generate monthly principal payments. The investment portfolio plays a significant role in liquidity management, whether it's helping to mitigate liquidity risk on the balance sheet or as a means to manage excess liquidity like we've been doing for a while. By managing the underlying mix of investments and their cash flows, you can build an effective liquidity tool for your community financial institution. I hope that you found what we've covered today to be helpful, especially given what we've been dealing with in the markets lately. If you have any questions on anything that I discussed about liquidity management today, please shoot me an email with your questions to chris@bondinvestmentmentor.com. And if you know someone that might benefit from today's topic, please feel free to share this episode with them. By the way, since I'm out in Boulder this week working with the Graduate School of Banking, I'll take this opportunity to remind you about the Bond Basics course that the Graduate School of Banking and Bond Investment Mentor teamed up to create for you. And if you're newer to your role in working with your institution's investment portfolio, I want to be sure that you know about this. The Bond Basics course covers the fundamentals of fixed income investments and managing a community financial institution's investment portfolio. Through the course, you'll learn all the essentials you need to develop your investment skills and help you feel more confident in your ability to make sound investment decisions for your institution's investment portfolio. You know, in creating this course, I focused on building the training that I wish I had had when I was first getting started. And now you've got this. The Bond Basics course will lay the foundation you need to get off to a solid start. If you're ready to take your investment skills to the next level, Bond Investment Mentor and GSBC have got you covered. To learn more about the Bond Basics course, head over to bondinvestmentmentor.com/bondbasics and sign up today. Well, I'm really glad that you stopped by and I appreciate you checking in. Bond Investment Mentor is written and produced by me, Chris Nelson. The information, views, and opinions expressed during the podcast belong solely to myself, and any ideas and strategies contained in the podcast are for educational and informational purposes only and do not constitute investment, accounting, or legal advice. As I said before, if you have any questions regarding the material I covered today, or if you have any topics or ideas that you'd like me to cover in a future episode, please email me at chris@bondinvestmentmentor.com. And if you haven't already, I'd like to invite you to follow the podcast so that you don't miss an episode. You can subscribe on any of the major platforms like Apple, Spotify, or through whatever podcast app that you use. And if you're looking for more information about fixed income investing and portfolio management, check out bondinvestmentmentor.com, where you'll find articles, tips, and resources to help you manage your institution's investment portfolio. You can also connect with me on social media. I would love to hear from you. I'm on LinkedIn at Christopher Nelson CFA or on Facebook at bondinvestmentmentor.com. Well, that's going to do it for this episode. I look forward to catching up with you again soon. Thanks for stopping by. Have a good one.